Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Judge Jessen, Judge Flory, the Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Good morning, counsel. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We're here on our second oral argument on our calendar this morning. This is the case A21-0113 in the matter of the welfare of LDK child. Counsel, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal argument. Counsel for appellant, 5 minutes rebuttal if you choose to use it. Go ahead and mute yourselves when you're not talking. When you begin your principal arguments, please state your name and the party you represent for the record. We will begin with counsel for appellant.
Thank you. I'm Matt Gerwood. I represent, I'm assistant county attorney for Becker County. I'll start out just by stating the primary goals of the juvenile justice system, in addition to maintaining public safety, are the skill development, habilitation, rehabilitation, and addressing treatment needs and successful reintegration of youth into the community. Many juveniles have been designated EJJ based on much less serious offenses with relatively clean criminal histories than in this case.
Mr. Jord, why did not your office designate this case EJJ when you filed the original petition?
Your Honor, I believe the thought was that due to the seriousness of the offense and not really having any other information on the file, that was the route they chose to go at that time.
All right.
So the purpose of the six public safety factors, which is Rule 1905, is to determine if the juvenile presents a risk to public safety and to predict the future risk to offend.
Do you agree that had you designated this matter EJJ in the original petition, that we would not be considering the public safety factors? The only issue then would have been probable cause under the rules?
I do not disagree with that, Your Honor. I didn't initially work on this file, but the reasoning I got was that due to what I just stated.
All right, thank you.
Yes. So neither the rule, the statute, nor the rule specifically indicate whether the current factors, which are the six factors, which really are the signposts for establishing EJJ, neither of them really indicate whether the current factors are inclusive or exclusive, since no language about the totality of the circumstances is in the current rule or statute, it would appear the six factors are meant to be inclusive. This becomes important in determining whether evidence about the child's home environment, current mental status, and pattern living is relevant, which I will get into a bit later. The first factor is really kind of the crucial part of this case. The court found that probable cause was sufficient to proceed with the designated charges. It seems to contradict itself in its analysis of the six factors. Case law states that in certification and EJJ hearings, the judicial determination of probable cause creates a presumption that the charges contained in the petition are true. This indicates that the juvenile can presumed guilty of the alleged offenses. As stated in our brief, the court seemed to focus on the respondent's intent and stated there's no evidence that he intended to cause death or harm.
So if I may, because I'm looking at that language as well, you know, if that first factor just said the seriousness of the alleged offense, skip the next phrase and said, including the existing of any aggravating factors, I would agree with you more, but it talks about the seriousness of the alleged offense. And I mean, obviously the offense here was very, very, very serious, but then it says in terms of community protection. So looking at that phrase, isn't that what the district court was trying to do, is talk about community protection today, given the intent and these other factors and focusing on that phrase? I mean, do you have any guidance from case law on what that phrase is intended to mean in this context?
Well, I don't have any specific guidance on case law. We kind of feel that in regards to the court kind of was focusing on intentional, and it may not have been intentional. I don't, you know, that's not really in dispute here, but she seemed to kind of apply a new requirement to Rule 1905 that really wasn't necessarily in the statute or the rule. The plain language, it seems to be contrary to that plain language. I guess
when I look at what the district court seemed to be talking about in terms of an ongoing community threat, doesn't that really relate, I'm suggesting, to that phrase, the seriousness of the offense in terms of community protection? So
I think
I'm wrong.
No, I think kind of the really what I was going to get to at the end is, I think it's undisputed that obviously there's no prior record of delinquency, but access about any information about the juvenile's program, placement needs, any of that, we don't really have that because it's so early in the stage of the case. And in regards to public safety, we just don't know at this point. Prior counsel on this case pointed out at the EJJ hearing to the court that EJJ status would give the district court more time to ensure the respondent could complete any necessary programming. We don't know. That's kind of the problem here. Other than the superficial data, which we have, which is very little, we just don't know.
But the state has the burden to show the public safety factors support EJJ. And if you don't know, doesn't that, why wouldn't that end the conversation?
Well, it would feel that way, but this is about as a traumatic event as one could be involved in. It was the death of a good friend. I mean, that's awful. I can't imagine how difficult that must be. And we don't know how he's dealing with it. We don't know how he's going to deal with it. We don't know what kind of services and support he has received, or does he plan on receiving? We don't know anything. And that's crucial information that we feel the court needs to make a sound, reasoned decision. Rule 19, okay, so...
Well, Mr. Jard, those things you just identified that we don't know, your office had an opportunity to ask for an EJJ study to look into all of those matters. And I don't believe you made such a request, did you?
Well, I don't know if it was specifically made. I guess we were kind of, or how I'm looking at it is that Rule 1903 Subdivision 1 starts out by stating the court on its own motion or the motion.
But did anybody ask the court to do that? I mean, I haven't seen it in the record. And getting back to Judge Jessen's point, you know, the state has the burden of proof here by clear and convincing evidence. And you had a tool available to you to gather the information that you're now claiming the court didn't have. That seems problematic to me.
Yes. And I guess that's kind of the basis of my argument. I feel like the court obviously didn't make a decision. They didn't have that information, which is essential. Case law states the psychological evaluations are crucial. It plays a central role in assessing whether a juvenile is a threat to public safety. So I feel like the court had the power to do that. If we didn't make the request, I feel like the court, obviously it starts out, the court may on its own motion request the EJJ study and psychological evaluation. So I feel like without that, that's just kind of the basis of everything here. That's the unknown. We just don't know until we have that. And that's concerning because EJJ supervision is more intensive and has a higher degree of accountability. It has better built-in deterrence than the traditional juvenile system. EJJ designation would allow supervision until he's 21 years old, which is over 2 more years, which could be very critical. And beyond that, we also have the possibility of the adult sanction should he not succeed, which is even more meaningful deterrent. The safety nets that provides, I feel like that's the purpose of the EJJ system. And I just, again, the purpose of the juvenile system is to rehabilitate and help. And I believe in this scenario, this is where those services are needed. I mean, like stated before, this traumatic event, he needs the tools, the coping mechanisms, but also to ensure that this type of incident doesn't happen again. We still don't really know exactly what happened. There's kind of conflicting evidence. So that's very concerning. And I feel like for the public safety, we need to know that the services are being provided. I don't know if I answered your question, Your Honor. But that's in regards to who requested. If we did request, I don't know. I don't believe so. But I was kind of, I guess my thought is the court, in making such a serious decision, would want to have that information, because case law states in two or three different cases that that's the central tool, especially with an offense of this nature.
But and that kind of begs the question about the state's burden. The court has no burden here. The court made a determination based upon the evidence that the state presented, and the state had a burden of showing by clear and convincing evidence that these public safety factors warranted an EJJ determination. It's troublesome to me that the state didn't attempt to provide that information as part of its burden of proof.
And Your Honor, I don't dispute that the burden is on the state, and it is troublesome. However, I also would like to point out that the juvenile court, it's, you know, its stated purpose is to rehabilitate and maintain public safety. And I feel like just the position the court has, it's more of like a caretaker position to ensure that juveniles are getting help. I feel like it's such a, obviously I've stated as an incident of this nature, I feel like it's such a crucial piece that past the burden, I feel like the court would want to ensure that they are fulfilling that obligation. I believe I would rest on that, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Seeing no other questions, we'll turn to the respondent.
Can you hear? I'm sorry, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I thought I was still muted. All right. Good morning, may I please the court, counsel. I'm Mark Nyvold, representing respondent LDK. You know, the
counsel, just one second. Move your microphone down just a little bit or something, just to make it a little less.
How's that, Your Honor?
I think that's better. Thanks.
All right, thank you. You know, the state knows that it didn't, that the court didn't ask for an EJJ study. Obviously, the court was familiar with the evidence. It knew that the state wasn't asking for an EJJ study. The court felt confident based on the information it had that this case, that the state had not carried its burden to prove by clear and convincing evidence that this case had to be designated as EJJ to protect public safety. And getting back to Judge Jessen's initial questions about, you know, what the court had in mind, obviously, you know, the court made its decision based on public safety. It said, as to the factor one, seriousness of the alleged offense, the court does not believe that LDK poses an ongoing threat to the community. All right, that and the record amply supports that. You know, you've got the prosecutor saying, explaining why, you know, he didn't make any argument about available dispositional options. He says, well, there's no programming history. Well, he has no programming history because he has no juvenile record, which again supports the district court finding that there's no, that there's practically zero public safety risk if this juvenile is given, if his case is retained in juvenile court. So, you know, the state, it seemed to me they're making sort of these half-hearted arguments, and they didn't want to ask for an EJJ study because I think, you know, they recognize that they're pulled in two directions. But I think the prosecutor recognizes that juvenile disposition is what protects public safety, that it doesn't have to be EJJ.
You know, Mr. Nyvold, I didn't see it in the record, and maybe you have, or you could point me to it. Was there ever any discussion at any of these hearings leading up to the court's order between the court and counsel even about an EJJ study? Did anyone ever broach that subject?
No, I don't recall that ever coming up. There was a transcript of the probable cause hearing, and I I would remember that because I several times throughout my brief, I point out that the court didn't order one and the state did not ask for one. If I had been able to cite anything that there'd been a discussion, I certainly would have. So I'm almost sure, practically positive that there wasn't any discussion about that.
And then one other question about what you were talking about and what Mr. Gerard talked about in terms of the seriousness of this offense. When I read the file, one rather glaring factual discrepancy jumped out at me, and it goes directly to seriousness, and that is the discrepancy between whether this was a contact wound or not in determining what the circumstances were here and how that might factor in on the court's determination on public safety. How was that issue addressed at the hearing?
Well, the defense pointed out that this was not a contact wound, and the court in its order indicates that although the preliminary autopsy, there was some evidence because of soot in the upper maxillary area, that it was a contact wound. The final autopsy said there wasn't any soot. And so, you know, the defense argued, and I think with record support, that this was not a contact wound. Either way, this was not an intentional shooting. Okay, I don't think the state disputes that. So whether the gun was 5 to 9 feet away or right in Emmy's face, in terms of culpability and offense seriousness, I don't think makes any difference. But the point is, we don't. The state of the record now is a final autopsy indicating, contrary to the initial autopsy, preliminary autopsy, that there wasn't any soot in that area indicating a contact, which indicates no soot, indicates no contact. Okay. But either way, the shooting was not intentional. It was a tragedy. And there's no doubt about that. But I hope I've answered the question.
Yeah, that's helpful. Thank you.
And significantly, the state doesn't make any challenge at all to the court's findings. The court found all six factors weighed against EJJ, but the state doesn't make any challenge to culpability, prior record. Of course, they can't. There is no prior record, or lack of a programming or history. Well, there is no programming history because he has no record. So, you know, they're left to talk about offense seriousness, but, you know, and adequacy of punishment. But they never did anything to try to show that their speculation about LDK having psychological issues, mental issues, whatever, they hadn't documented them. They don't know what kind of mental health problems he may already have or may have as a result of this, because they didn't ask for a study. So, you know, for them to now challenge the court's decision not to designate as EJJ is, again, they're pulled in two directions. But I think the signal here is that the prosecution can certainly live with a non-EJJ disposition. I think that's clear. And I understand, why they took the position they did, but they didn't do anything to carry their burden. That's for sure. I mean, you can't just come in and speculate and say, well, we don't know if it's justice if he doesn't get EJJ. Well, you can't, this court's own case law says you can't extend the time of jurisdiction by asking for EJJ without some showing that additional time is necessary. And they didn't do anything to show that. You know, it's a tragic case, but they had the burden and they didn't meet it. And there's just no disputing that.
So, Mr. Neibel, how do you address the state's argument that this is a juvenile court proceeding? The judge has different responsibilities in juvenile court, has an overarching responsibility to really look at the best interests of the juvenile in addition to the public. And because of that, the court had some responsibility without a motion from the state to order an EJJ study here that perhaps would have gathered some of this other information regarding the juvenile here. What's your response to that suggestion by the state?
Well, the judge was, I think, had a good factual basis for not ordering an EJJ study. Okay, first you have a child who has zero record, all right? Second, this was not an intentional killing. He was good friends, best friends with the decedent. He has obviously no mental or psychological deficits that anyone had seen up until this time or even now. So on what basis, I guess, would the court have decided to order an EJJ study? There's nothing mysterious or complicated about this case. It was a tragic shooting. He was showing off the gun. The gun went off. That is not indicative of the need for an EJJ study, where there's never been any indication prior to that that this child had any problems at all or any need or any tendency to commit any criminal conduct. So I don't see that the court, it would have to be an extraordinary case and far more different factually than this case for the court to say, or for this court to say, district court, you had an obligation that was clear factually and legally to order what is by rule a discretionary study. So, I mean, that would really tell courts, I'm going to order an EJJ study in every case now, just so that I'm not questioned about why I didn't do it here. And this case presents no basis really to question the judge's decision not to order it. And the state had the burden to prove this. They could have ordered it. So I don't think the judge can be criticized here, but if the state has the authority to request this and they don't do it, I don't know how the judge can be second guessed in not ordering it. There's just, you know, it's a death case, a loss of life, but, and I know that, you know, gives it a different perspective, but that doesn't change the rules or actually fairness or common sense. Okay. I have no further argument unless there are questions by the court. Okay. Thank you. We ask the court to affirm the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Now you can mute. If you would please. Rebuttal, counsel for appellant.
Thank you. In regards to, there was brief mention of the actual injury, the contact wound, there's conflicting autopsies. I feel like the fact that there is conflicting autopsies and sort of in an undercurrent of two different stories to how this happened, I feel like that's alarming. And I feel like this is a serious act, even if it was done joking or it wasn't intentional. And I don't think anybody does believe it was intentional. I don't think that's disputed, but the lack of judgment, playing with a firearm, and this wasn't an 8-year-old, this was a 17-year-old, especially if he has a background in hunting, which we don't know. But the lack of judgment, being nearly an adult, handling a weapon that way is very concerning. And again, that plays into all the unknowns we just don't know. I feel like really we kind of had mentioned how the court has a obligation. It's a different obligation, the best interest. The burden may be on the attorney or the state to prove by clear and convincing evidence, but I also kind of relate this to like a Chips case where the court's not going to make a decision without having some reports. And I feel like it does parallel that, where the court just didn't have the information, and that was stated from the beginning. And with these behaviors and the unknowns, it's not only protect public safety, but the juvenile, you know, maybe he doesn't need anything. Maybe he just needs some therapy to help with it, but we just don't know. And I feel without that study, it's going to continue to be unknown. And maybe he needs 2 years. Maybe an EJJ study should be required. Maybe that should be a new change that is made. Either way, there's just a lot of unknowns. And I guess at the very least, we would request this be remanded back to have that study done so we can be sure that everything is covered. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your briefing and arguments. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in the statutory timeframe. Thank you.